Okay. I'm ready whenever you are.
Okay.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
That is me. I'm here. I'm happy to be here. Hello, Paul.
Hello. Yeah, we've had a few delays in our recording, so it's good to be here and actually doing this.
We're doing the thing and stuff.
Yeah, we are. So today on the program, put on some black clothing, twirl on some dark eyeliner, and crank up some Sisters of Mercy. We're talking about death. Specifically, Neil Gaiman's version of death, who's actually quite lovely. But before,
She is quite lovely.
But before we do that, there is something in the world of comics that has happened, and we should mention it. And that is the passing of the legendary creator, Steve Ditko. So I have some thoughts on Steve Ditko, but I'm going to let you go first.
I have feels about Steve Ditko.
Wow. So what are your feelings, memories, things you want to say about Mr. Ditko?
So Steve Ditko obviously was, as many of us know, was instrumental in creating Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And well, also Doctor Strange and numerous other characters. Also some reinvention or creation of some of the Charlton characters that have become beloved or stolen by Alan Moore for Watchmen, however you want to look at it.
It's a parody and a satire.
Oh, right, right. Yes, yes. And it's an unauthorized, so Alan Moore.
It's a satire. Do you not know what satire is? All right, keep going.
Alan Moore's unauthorized version of Charlton characters.
Wow.
So, obviously, you can't be a comic book fan and not have seen and either seen Ditko's work or seen his vast influence on certain characters. We wouldn't have Spider-Man if it weren't for Steve Ditko. Mm. And of course, he had that kind of trippy style that you really didn't, that really showed up in Doctor Strange. I had mistakenly, it was humorous when I tried to do a tribute to him on the book face that the kids are into. I mistakenly said Nick Fury as opposed to Doctor Strange. Luckily, someone quickly corrected me.
Oh, wow.
Rather embarrassing. I meant Doctor Strange, but I said Nick Fury.
I could see how you could make that mistake. They're almost identical.
except completely different. Yeah. Except they both had trippy art.
Right, right. But,
yeah, so
it's one
of those embarrassing moments where you misspeak, but unfortunately you misspeak on a social media platform. And luckily someone was able to be like, didn't you mean somebody else instead? I was like, oh crap.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
So people are so forgiving on social media. It's great.
They sure are. I left the correction there because I felt like I needed to own it. But the Doctor Strange stuff I actually liked more than Spider-Man, except Spider-Man is one of the most, if not, I can't say he's the most iconic because you have Superman, but outside of Superman, and even probably above Batman, Spider-Man is the most recognizable superhero character.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that.
And it probably, he would not have existed. I was reading some perhaps apocryphal stuff about how Stan Lee wanted Spider-Man to go. And there were some goofy names that Stan Lee wanted to use and some really wacky costuming. And yeah,
Kirby.
Right. Because I think Kirby was originally supposed to do Spider-Man with Stan Lee. Right. And the feeling was that Kirby was too cosmic.
Well, Kirby's big and grand and chunky and everything's gigantic. And yes. Where Ditko was small and ground level, which is exactly what Spider-Man needs to be.
Which is what was needed. There is so much about modern comics that would not exist if it weren't for Ditko's vision as a comic book artist.
Yes.
During his brief, and let's be honest, it was a brief tenure at Marvel.
Yes, and he did come back to Marvel late 80s, 90s, because he created Squirrel Girl.
Created Squirrel Girl, that's right.
Yeah, and who's the other one?
Creeper. He created the Creeper, I believe, as well.
Well, for DC.
Yeah. For DC, yes.
Yeah. So DC, for DC, his credits include, you know, Creeper, Hawk and Dove, and then Blue Beetle, The Question, and Mr. A. And now, so here's the thing. I'm going to piss
you really
off
want to talk about Mr. A, don't you? And
yeah,
The Question.
I'm going to piss off everybody, but because I'm of two minds with Steve Ditko. On the one hand, I think he's a fantastic artist, and on the other hand, I think he's a terrible, terrible writer. But before I say anything about that, let me be perfectly clear. Steve Ditko is one of the greatest comic book artists of all time. He is a pioneer. He is an innovator. He's influenced generations of creators and deserves all the praise and adulation he gets for his drawing style, his layouts, his character design, all of that. And I will never, ever say that Steve Ditko was not important in the world of comics, because that's just false. But I don't think he was a good writer. And that has a lot
We come not to bury Caesar.
Well, that's because of the themes he chose to write about. I find them questionable. And that a lot of that has to do with the Ayn Rand objectionist philosophy that he was a devout adherent of. And Mr. A is problematic. Everything is black and white. There is no shades of gray. In fact, he was very adamant about saying that if you have any doubt in your vision, then it's useless and it's meaningless. So I don't agree with him philosophically. And I have to say, people give Stan Lee a hard time, and there's a lot of it that he deserves. But Spider-Man wouldn't be Spider-Man without Stan Lee's direction. Had it been left totally up to Ditko, I think Spider-Man would be a completely different character than what we have today. Not the look. The look is iconic. The look is brilliant. The look is amazing. That's probably what made him so popular, was his look. But right. the way his character developed, I think a lot of it had to do with Stan Lee's direction. Maybe not his writing, but his direction. Right. Well, it was a partnership. It was
the Marvel style, where the writer didn't actually write dialogue. Or not initially. Well, they would give a generic plot line, and then the artist would take sort of the overarching theme, and then the artist was actually creating. So the writer was not giving panel by panel directions. The artist was creating the story based on an outline, right? And then writer Stan Lee would fill in the dialogue and what have you after the art was done.
Right. Yeah. The Marvel method. So yeah. So yeah. Stan Lee would say, "Here's the storyline I'm thinking of. Go create the panels." And left the artist up, whether it was Kirby, whether it was Ditko, whether it was insert name here that I'm blanking on right now. But yeah, but that, you know, it worked really well, and it allowed Stan Lee to write, what, how many, 20 comics a month?
500 million individual issues.
But we're not talking about Stan Lee here. We're talking about Ditko. And right. You know, I find some of his stuff sort of, like I said, problematic. Like Hawk and Dove, for instance, is... When he was writing,
there's your black and white right there.
Yeah,
peace and war.
Specifically, I don't know if it's the first issue of Hawk and Dove, but it's one of the first where it has Hawk and Dove kind of on either side of the page, and in the middle a bunch of placards describing who they are. And Hawk is chest out, fist held, you know, right fist, you know, in a held up by his chest, looking very dramatic. And then Dove is kind of slumped. His hands hanging down over his crotch, eyes cast downward. And it's like the challenger and the challenged is what it says. It's like, wow, can you be, there was no subtlety to Ditko's work, or Ditko's writing, I should say. And I find that it kind of diminishes him in my eyes. And I know that's going to really anger a lot of people, because so many people just adore Ditko. And I adore his art.
It's okay to adore him as an artist. It's okay to appreciate him as an artist and be not so keen on him as a person or as a writer. I mean,
I don't know who he was as a person.
There are some artists out there who hold certain views that I am very strongly opposed to. But at the same time, I look at their body of work.
Yeah. And it's not
as artists.
Well, here's the thing. So me, I'm a writer, and it's not a compelling story when it's just, you know, the good guys are good, the bad guys are bad. And that's not a compelling story at all.
Right.
So regardless of, you know, there are plenty of writers out there who I disagree with their politics, but they're telling good stories, and I can enjoy it for what it is. Ditko's stories just did not do that for me.
It's sort of like Dave Sim and Cerebus.
Yeah, there you go.
A very unpleasant human being, by all accounts.
Yeah.
And it's, but Cerebus is a singular, amazing work that should be read. Well, should be. I do not wish to tell anybody what they should or should not read. This is this is America, dadgummit.
For now.
For now.
I mean, I understand if people disagree with me. I totally get it. And I know I'm in the minority when it comes to Ditko. So please feel free to vent at me. Send, you know.
That'd be great. You're not necessarily in the minority. It's, again, because you and others can separate, and myself and others can separate the message from the medium in some ways. I understand that there's going to be the message is the medium, or the medium is the message, but
his, I you know,
we're celebrating him as an artist, not as a writer.
Absolutely. And as a creator, his characters, his character design and the characters he created were very, very compelling. I just think they were done better with other writers using them. Squirrel Girl now is one of the most adorable characters in the world. If you actually read his first Squirrel Girl comic, it's kind of mean. It's mean-spirited.
I don't think I've ever read the original. I have not followed Squirrel Girl. Yeah. I have run across her in numerous comics that she has appeared in, but I can't say that I am an avid fan who has collected all Squirrel Girl appearances.
Yeah, well, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl is a fine comic that just makes me smile when I read it. So perhaps we'll do that on an upcoming episode.
And she's never been defeated, right? That's the thing?
Yes, she's never been defeated. She's even beaten Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom, right. that still holds? She still is she's still undefeated?
The only reason I'm hesitating is because
you haven't read the last most recent.
Yeah, exactly. So there's probably someone who knows much more of the lore of Squirrel Girl than I do.
Squirrel Girl lore. Oh. You just got to go to the Ditko page and scroll through all the Anus Randisms and get to the Squirrel Girl folder.
Oh, Anus Randisms. Okay, so that's it. So anyway, anyone, please hurl your disapproval towards me in the upcoming days and weeks. I get it. But let it be known, I do appreciate Ditko's legacy and what he did for the medium of comics, because
as a visual artist, he is a giant.
Absolutely. I just want to talk about, I don't want this to be obituary corner, but Harlan Ellison passed a couple of weeks ago as well. And although he's not specifically a comics guy, he was involved with comics quite a bit, at least peripherally. He wrote a few comics. He had his stories adapted into comics. And he's one of my favorite writers. Another fairly unpleasant person by all accounts. But his writing was outstanding, and I just wanted to acknowledge his passing. And he will be missed by me.
And myself as well. I'm a big Harlan Ellison fan as well. So as a writer, I had just finished, oddly enough, a week or so before he died, I had just finished a novel of his that Hard Case Crime had just reprinted. It was a hard-boiled crime novel that he had written that was recently reprinted by Hard Case Crime, which is a great imprint. If you want to read great hard-boiled crime novels, Hard Case Crime is where to go. A shout out to one of my favorite imprints, it was fun reading the book and seeing how he could switch genres so easily and still be a compelling writer within whatever genre he chose to. He's most famous, of course, for sci-fi, but the genres that he could write in and the way he could pivot.
Yeah, I think
his writing was quite astonishing, and especially when he was writing a lot of the bulk of his writing was done at a time in which the genre fictions were considered to not be literary.
Yeah, well, he
was one of the cats.
I could be wrong about this, but I believe he's the one who coined the phrase speculative fiction, because sci-fi at that time, when he was starting out, was either Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke, or it was hardcore science,
you know, right,
projecting it into the future and what's the world going to be like using this real world science and technology. Or it was, you know, 1950s, let's go to the moon and find a civilization of people.
And all of the books published on those like cheap mass market with the lurid, the great covers.
Right. Well, yeah, they were great.
A lost art. I mean, Chip Kidd kind of is still keeping interesting covers alive, but for the most part, like all those great covers at the time are gone. That has nothing to do with Harlan Ellison, except he was publishing his novels in these cheap imprints, mass market imprints, but selling millions of copies, you know, in drugstores and in grocery stores and on newsstands or wherever you would pick these books up. Everybody was buying this stuff. Everybody was reading these things. And Harlan Ellison was one of the leading writers in that time frame.
Yeah. But he was able to take, you know, he coined the phrase speculative fiction, where he was able to take current events or current ideas and put a sci-fi framework where, you know, he would talk about racism and sexism and, you know, gender issues and so forth. And he would psychological issues, but he would put that sci-fi blanket around it. So it took it out of, how do I say this? It took your frame of reference away so that you're not immediately thinking about, you know, what's happening today, because it's in the future and it's a different planet or something like that. So you're able to really get into these ideas and these issues and think about them in a really different way. And he used the genre of science fiction to really push those ideas and those issues. He was amazing at it.
He was a pretty progressive thinker in a genre at the time, but a pretty progressive social thinker in a time in which that genre was very largely conservative. And I don't mean conservative like we think of it now. I mean just conservative. Yeah. Obviously, they were creating fantastical worlds, but they were not necessarily socially forward.
Not big C conservative, little C.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was, you know, he was the one who helped.
And small P progressive as opposed to big P progressive.
Exactly. Yeah. But he was part of that whole group of people who knew the new wave science fiction writers of the 70s that really changed things. So there goes Harlan Ellison. He will be missed. I just heard this anecdote recently. Ellison had a whole bunch of his short stories. I think it was Dark Horse. I could be wrong about that. You know, adapted into comic book form. And John Byrne did a version.
Another noted crank.
Yeah. Did a version of I Have No Mouth, But I'm a Scream. But he changed it quite a bit. He adapted it to his own ideas. Ellison apparently was so pissed by this, he forced Dark Horse to, on the margins, print the original story word for word so that you could see how he changed it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he was.
I haven't read that. I that's something to track down.
Yeah. Well, I think that's actually pretty intriguing, but you got it. You know, that he didn't back down to anybody. All right. So there it is.
All right. Because of our, it is interesting that today we are talking about dead people, because our topic today is death.
Very good. That was unplanned, but wow.
It was.
It's very thematic. All right. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about death.
Adventures into the unknown.
Tales from the crypt.
Skeleton Hand.
The Haunt of Fear.
The Vault of Horror.
Adventures into Terror.
Strange Tales.
Uncanny Tales.
Journey into Mystery.
The House of Secrets.
The House of Mystery.
The Phantom Stranger.
Doctor 13.
Doorway to Nightmare.
The Witching Hour.
Strange Suspense Stories.
Worlds of Fear.
Chamber of Chills.
Terror Tales.
The Beyond.
Tomb of Terror.
Weird War Tales.
The Twilight Zone.
Creepy.
Dark Shadows.
Vampirella.
The Haunted Tank.
The Heap.
Eerie.
Swamp Thing.
Weird Mysteries,
Tomb of Dracula,
Tales of the Unexpected,
Werewolf by Night,
The Demon,
Man-Thing,
Monster of Frankenstein,
Brother Voodoo,
The Son of Satan,
Night Force,
The Living Mummy,
The Sandman,
Tomb of Darkness,
Evil Ernie,
Saga of the Swamp Thing,
Flinch,
Hellblazer,
30 Days of Night,
Preacher,
The Walking Dead.
What do these titles have in common? All of them. From Adventures into the Unknown, to Tales from the Crypt, to The House of Mystery, to The Tomb of Dracula, may be found in the Long Box of Darkness. I'm your host, Herman Lowe. Join me every Monday night for a journey into comic book horror as we delve into the secrets of the Long Box of Darkness.
So listen if you dare, puny mortals, to the Long Box of Darkness, available on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podbean. And check out the blog at www.longboxofdarkness.com. Good night, and pleasant screams.
And we're back. So today on the program, we're talking about death. Brian, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Paul. So, death, the high cost of living, and death, the time of your life, are three-issue miniseries published by Vertigo Comics in the early 1990s. Written by internet diarist and occasional voice actor Neil Gaiman and illustrated by Chris Boccolo, the two slight series encompass the anthropomorphic representation of death, her relationship with the human world. Gaiman is best known for his work on a variety of 2000 AD comics, a few DC one-off issues, and several Marvel comics series, including The Eternals, Marvel 1602, and most famously, The Last Temptation, a comic book adaptation of an Alice Cooper album. More popularly, he has found fame as a voice actor in such shows as Arthur, The Simpsons, and Lucifer. He had a small role in an episode of the Big Bang series earlier this year. Chris Boccolo's art has graced numerous important comics, including long runs on the X-Men, Doctor Strange, and Shay the Changing Man. In Death, the High Cost of Living, Death fulfills her once every 100 years duty and becomes fully human for 24 hours. She is tasked, in this state, with finding Mad Hetty's heart, and along the way meets and befriends various honest-to-God human beings. Some very bad things happen along the way, but lessons are learned, cheeks are kissed, and lives are changed, mostly for the better. Some folks have lots of sads reading this story. Death, the High Cost of Living, finds our titular hero in the periphery as a group of friends previously met navigate betrayal and loss, hope and despair, and come to grips with the frailty of life. Death is present to help them along the paths they have chosen. Some folks have lots of sads reading this story as well. Death is presented to humans as a goth woman of varying ages, wearing all black and sporting a silver Ankh necklace. She is present at the beginning of all things and will be the last to close the door when all things come to a final end. She's also very friendly and pleasant to be around. So, Paul, I recommended this. You and I both had not read either of these two series in quite some time. What did you think?
Well, first of all, I should point out that there's a couple of things that Neil Gaiman did that you might have left out of that introduction.
Well, I think he was in a couple more shows, and I think he wrote a book with Terry Pratchett as well.
True, he did indeed write a show with Terry Pratchett, which is itself is going to be a show starring the Doctor. But...
Oh, he wrote an issue of Batman.
Yes, he's been very prolific. He's also written Green Lantern as well.
Yes.
But Brian, come now. You know he's written another comic book series that was somewhat influential.
American Gods.
There is an adaptation of that. You are correct.
There is, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, now he's written Sandman.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. Well, I don't know if anybody's read that.
It is fairly obscure.
Yes.
It's really hard to get your hands on.
I mean, I think he's come a long way in his life.
Yes. Yes. Good for Mr. Gaiman. He's actually, he's done good. He's done well for himself.
He's done a few. Yeah. He's done some things.
So it's easy to forget just how good of a comic book writer Neil Gaiman is.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. Aside from just being a good storyteller, he works in this medium just brilliantly. His plotting and his pacing, it's just, there's just a natural ease. And you're told this massive amount of information in mythology. I mean, this is some big stuff that he's talking about, but he's able to convey a lot of information really succinctly and get you involved in the characters rather than having to be.
Also with, and some of that is with the help of the artists. That
absolutely. I guess that's what I mean by how he works so well in this medium, because he knows exactly how to work with the artists he's with. Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's so much information and mythology that's conveyed to you in just a few lines and a handful of panels. I mean, it's truly outstanding. All right. I suppose I should say at the outset, yeah, I'm a massive fan of Neil Gaiman. So there's not going to be a lot of down, I don't know, for me putting him down in any way. So.
Right. I think one of the things with my intro and the omission that I did was that I kind of wanted to approach, as impossible as it may seem, these two series on their own merits rather than just as a, not bookend, but as a part of sort of a larger series that obviously it had come from.
Right. Well, I mean, but, you know, Death as a character is intricately woven into the mythology of Sandman.
But intentionally not used very often.
Yes. Well, first of all, to make Death, personification of Death, just adorable woman, smiley and bubbly and just so happy to be around. That's just fantastic.
Right.
I remember the first time, and it's actually, I think this, her origin story is actually in this collection that we're talking about. We're going to try to stay on target. But I remember
stay on target. Stay on target.
I remember reading Sandman, because I read Sandman when it was coming out at the time from Vertigo, and you know, Death had been mentioned in several stories leading up to her first appearance.
She is the sibling, one of the siblings of Morpheus, aka
Morpheus
Dream.
Yeah, and then when she appears, it was such a—I don't know—it was—it was not shocking, but it was just a pleasant surprise. It's like, wow. I was not expecting that at all. Cause I, you know, I have in my mind, sickle wielding, scythe. Let's try that again. Scythe wielding black robed, you know, skeleton that you always see.
Sure.
Yeah. And then just to see this, you know, lovely little goth girl come out of nowhere. It's really great.
Woman.
Woman. I'm sorry. No, I'm not. Goth girl is alliterative, and I'm going to stick with it. I like the sound of the words together. So I really enjoy the whole concept of this character. But if you want to get, into the actual.
Well, I think her appearance and the way that, although it wasn't Gaiman who came up with it, was Dave McKeon, I believe, who
was it? I thought it was Gaiman who he based it on Tori Amos.
No. That's actually a common misconception. She's actually based on a woman named Cinnamon Hadley, who died recently. But she was a friend of Mike Dringenberg, who is the co-creator. So when you see the credits for her, she is created by Mike Dringenberg and Neil Gaiman. But she is based on a friend of Dringenberg named Cinnamon Hadley. And Neil Gaiman has famously said that he didn't... his vision of what she was going to look like was different, but when he saw Dringenberg's representation of her, his outline is his artistic outline. Gaiman went with that immediately.
Well, that's great. I did not know that. That's wow. That you've rocked my world.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the Tori Amos, the rather famous Tori Amos Neil Gaiman death triangle that a lot of people associate with it. I always...
That just sounds funny to say. Neil Gaiman Tori Amos death triangle.
It's a new goth band.
It was a cult started in the 90s. Brief, very brief.
I think it's always been overstated. And
okay. That was the story I heard, and I just assumed that was true. So,
and part of me, who is not a Tori Amos fan, would have been fascinated to see if Neil Gaiman had discovered PJ Harvey before Tori Amos, and how that would have worked out.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. Okay, what other ideas and knowledge that I have are you going to tear apart?
That's all I got, Paul. We could talk about the comic now.
Okay, let's do that. So, all right, do you want to split these up into two?
I mean, we can, or we could talk about the... So,
well, they're very connected. I mean,
they're very connected.
They're two separate stories, but they have an overarching... I mean, some of the same characters, and they...
Now, what I have found, going back and rereading them after many years, is that I have... there is one of the series I think is stronger than the other.
Okay.
So for me, again, this was my recommendation, so now it's going to sound like I'm poo-pooing my recommendation. I do have some reservations about both of the series. I also have things about it that I love, both of them that I love greatly as well.
Okay.
But to me, I think The High Cost of Living is a much stronger story than The Time of Your Life.
Okay.
And some of that has to do with characterization. Some of it has to do with what I would consider the strength of the plot and the thematic strengths.
Okay. I don't disagree with that. I kind of think that they're both strong. I mean, they have their own, they're both strong for their own reasons. Anyway, continue. I'm sorry. I cut you off. Right.
The High Cost of Living is the story in which Death spends 24 hours as a human. And I think that that is why I think it's a stronger story, because she is drawn in. I think it's very interesting the way Gaiman presents it, is that it's the very small things that she is most interested in. She's not interested in the big concepts.
Right. No. In fact, one example of that is when she eats a hot dog. And she says,
right. And you know, the chemical
aftertaste. There's a chemical aftertaste. Is that just a bonus?
Exactly.
So that sort of thing. And, you know, I kind of speaking to that point, there's a lot of what would typically be, especially in a 90s comic, what it would be these gigantic cosmic consequences to this whole story, and it's really in the end not all those huge, you know, all the people who you think are going to be these massive villains who are going to have these massive consequences are really just pushed away. That's not really what the story is about. The story is about,
and even,
you know, meeting people.
Right. And even the big, right. And even the big bad, or who is supposed to be the big bad in the story. And he is a bad guy, but even in the end, he does the right thing, and he does what he's supposed to do, and does that. It's hard to explain without giving spoilers, although I imagine most people have read this. So he puts the two pennies on Dee Dee, who is Death's human persona in this story. He puts the two pennies on her eyes to allow her to move back to her realm and resume her duties.
Yes, but it's implied that that would have happened anyway. He just, you know, because it's the same thing when he tries to steal her Ankh necklace, which he thinks is the, you know, it's the receptacle of all her power.
Right.
But as it turns out, she just buys another one.
Right.
A cheap replacement. It's a
that symbol. She's lucky is even metal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, and that's what, you know, kind of the brilliance of Gaiman is that these aren't true. These objects are just symbols, and the symbol is imbued with as much power as you put into it.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not the thing. It's the idea of the thing.
But we also find out that the symbol must exist with her. When she loses that symbol, she does lose a bit of her power. There's the scene where,
yes,
when that symbol, when the big bad, the, what's his name? The, I want to say the Emeritus, which is not the right word. It's
it's the Eremite.
The Eremite, yes. Mm-hmm. When the Eremite who has discovered that she is now in human form. When he's coming after her for reasons that are never really explained. They have a long history. And some of the things when I talk about this, I'm going to talk about things that are contained in this story and that I'm not going to reference things in The Sandman, because I want to talk about these stories just as their own pieces. So when we talk about characters who have appeared in The Sandman series and are also appearing in this series, I think the stories need to stand on their own. And so I'm not really that interested in, say, Foxglove or Hazel, any of those characters as they appear in Sandman and that one very terrible night in Sandman. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about them in context of this series.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
So the Eremite is, we never get a full explanation as to why he is so obsessed with coming after death in her once every 100 years human form, and why what we don't know his beef. His beef with her is not exactly explained, and it's not important. It doesn't really matter. What we know is that something exists between them, and this is what Gaiman does throughout his works, is he only tells you as much as you need to know. And when you read all of his works, he leaves you, the reader, to fill in your own blanks in many cases.
Yeah, the ambiguity that he leaves a lot of things ambiguous so right. that you, the reader, can think about what happened in the past. He doesn't have to explain it to you. You know, he explains what you need to know, like you said.
Right. So the Eremite, in a bit of trickery and murder, of course, comes into possession of the Ankh that Death, in her human guise as Didi, is wearing. And he thinks that he has scored the answer to whatever his quest is.
Which we assume is eternal life.
Eternal life, right. Or dominion over life. But so when he takes that, we had this whole scene. He is captured Death and her young male friend and keeps them locked up, and he takes the Ankh. And we see in subsequent scenes where she starts to lose her connection with her power or her persona as an endless, and becomes more and more like, because the facet she takes on is, I believe the girl is supposed to be like around 14 to 16, somewhere in that age group. And she becomes more and more like what you would expect a 14 or 15 or 16 year old to start thinking like and acting like. So the symbol is important. It's just not, but later on, of course, when she recovers, when she gets another Ankh,
she remembers herself, you know.
She remembers herself and the powers of her facet start returning. So it's not the individual piece, but it is the symbol in contact with her that is what gives her her power. Does that sound correct? Is that your reading of it as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's, you know, this is actually a recurring theme through both of these stories, where it's the symbol is the idea, not the object. So
right.
Things are what we believe them to be. Like when Mad Hetty keeps looking for her
one
heart.
One of my favorite characters in all of comics.
Well, this is, you know, and this is, again, you know, tribute to Gaiman. He sets up Mad Hetty as if she's going to be this, you know, really cruel, horrible, because she, you know, she's mean.
she kills the bird to read its entrails at the very beginning.
You know, you can understand that. I mean, a little divination, old school right. divination. I mean, you know, you gotta lose some birds. But but no, she does hold our who's the boy?
Sexton Furnival.
Yes, right. So she holds Sexton with a broken bottle to his neck. You know, so she looks, you know, she looks mean. She looks right. tough. But he says, you know, help me find my heart. Death says okay, and it's like, okay, we're fine now. Yeah. and the thing is, when they do find her heart, spoilers, it's just a necklace of a heart. It's the
symbol. Or is it?
Well, that's the thing. The symbol, the symbol is the reality. You know, it's.
And of course, the heart is hidden within a Russian doll, and all the layers.
Yes, nested way down deep.
Ooh, we're just giving all kinds of spoilers away. One has to assume if one has read comics, though, that they've read this series.
Yeah, this isn't. I doubt this will be a surprise to anyone.
No, but Mad Hetty is also she's such a great character. You know, she's 250 years old. Poor Sexton. So Sexton Furnival is the character that Death Wreck, who is trying to commit. So at the beginning of the show, at the beginning of the series, it's basically Sexton Furtival is writing his suicide note. And it's a very mature suicide note. He's got a very mature view on death, or the actual act, not the personification.
With some teenage angst thrown in there. For
with some teenage angst. I mean, you know, he's been listening to some Tori Amos as well. But, you know, and so then he goes and is standing in a garbage heap, ends up falling, and he doesn't want to die at that point. So he, like, scrambles up and tries to protect himself. And, of course, he gets buried in trash. And that's when Death comes along in her human guise and saves him or rescues him.
Well, it's you know, and another symbolic message in the story where he wants to die, but it's Death who shows him that. It's Death who shows him how to live. Yes, exactly. That's so lovely. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little obvious in some ways. Again, I don't mean this as an overt criticism. It is a criticism, but it's not necessarily bad.
But this was this style of writing, this kind of comic book writing was very new and very innovative at this time. So many people have read Gaiman and have gone on to use his ideas and themes that it does seem a little simple. It does seem a little obvious. But like I said, when I read this the first time, I was surprised by it. It was different. All right. Let me, okay. So, all right. In one story, when they're in a club, they meet a girl with long gloves.
Right. Who tells a story
about, and you know, it's in the third person where there's an abused girl who tries to kill herself, but then fails at trying to kill herself and then moves to the city to get away and start a new life.
Right. It's very and part of the reason the way she tries to kill herself is by slicing up her arms.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very moving. I thought, I mean, you could disagree with me or not, but
it's
just an aside. It's very quick. That character does come back in a way at the end.
Yes. In a very nice way.
Yes. But, all right. So I'm using her as an example because Gaiman was able to... All right. Let me say it this way. In the 90s, many writers added some extreme details to their stories, whether it be violence, sex, sexual violence, anything that would make the story seem dark and gritty. Now, right. Gaiman did that too. But with other writers, this sort of thing tended to come off as exploitative or gratuitous. With Gaiman, it always seemed to have a touch of sadness and melancholy, and it always fit the story and enhanced the story, pushed it forward so that there was darkness, but there was darkness for a reason.
Right.
And that's what makes it new.
And with that character, who is, I think, one of the more pivotal characters in this series, this particular mini, she's only on it for like, what, 10 panels, 12 panels at most? Yeah. But it's the story she tells to Sexton, our intrepid hero.
the clueless man who just gets blown along by circumstance. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, the whole three issues, he just bumbles along following Death around. She has adopted him. And for reasons all of her own, she has adopted him. And of course he's the skeptic. He doesn't believe, he's not even skeptical in like the way a real skeptic would be. He's skeptical like a 15-year-old emo kid would be. He's like, I don't believe any of this. you're not really dead. You know, she tells him over and over again. And every scene.
And very crazy people tell him that too. And he's
right. Mad Hetty tells him that. Yeah. Everybody tells him that she's Death, and he just completely refuses to believe it. Everybody gives her things for free, which is also like one of the great running gags throughout the series, is that no matter where she goes, she gets the hot dog for free. She gets her bagels for free. She gets the cab ride for free.
It's implied that people know and understand who she is, even if they don't know and understand.
They don't know it, but at the same time, yeah. You know, and of course he's like, how come you get everything for free? And she's like, nothing is ever free.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really nice ground level story. You know, it seems as if it's going, like I said in the beginning, it seems like it's going to have this huge cosmic ramifications. But in the end, it's just about meeting individuals and meeting people which is exactly what the whole point of her coming to Earth in the first place.
And the characterization of all the people she meets. I mean, we have Hazel and Foxglove, who readers, of course, recognize from a different series, who went through a very traumatic moment in their lives in the past. And they're introduced, again, very briefly in the club scene where...
Foxglove is now a singer-songwriter.
Foxglove is now a singer writing some really bad lyrics.
Yeah.
I have to say, in both of these two series, there's a reason Neil Gaiman writes novels.
I think that's intentional, though.
I have always hoped it has, but then when I read Tori Amos lyrics, I'm like, oh, he might actually think this is good lyric writing.
No. I've read Gaiman's poetry, and his poetry is actually quite good. I think this is intentional. He's mimicking that Tori Amos. I mean, there's a shout out to Michelle Schacht, which is nice.
Yes, there is. which is kind of fun, because I think at the time this was written, Michelle Schacht hadn't become completely batshit crazy like she is now.
Yeah, but you know, I think that scene, it's actually, you know, to go back to a previous episode that we've done in Phonogram, there's a similar type of calling out to that singer-songwriter who's just so dark and right, trying to pour their heart out to you, you know, with the acoustic guitar and wearing all black. So yeah. I think Gaiman's intentionally making this a little bit over the top and a little bit schmaltzy, you know, pretentious poetry.
It's so pretentious.
Who is the singer? Jewel. Do you remember Jewel?
Unfortunately.
Yes. So that was another example of, you know, just the worst lyrics you could possibly think of.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was going on at the time, and I think that was intentional.
But I think that club scene is also, because of the introduction of, and I'm curious, when I go back and read this now, it's easy to make assumptions about what Gaiman's plan was, whether he even had another plot in mind for another Death miniseries or not. Having Hazel and Foxglove in that scene, and it sets up the next mini in so many ways. And I've always been curious whether he had in mind the next story he was going to tell, or if when he went to write the next story, he went back and decided that scene with Hazel and Foxglove was a good jumping off point for the next series.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean,
who can tell?
Yeah, you can't really get into his mind unless he tells us that. But
he does seamlessly work that. He does seamlessly work the club scene into the high cost of living. Well, it's a springboard for the high cost of living.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's very good at that.
Yeah.
You can, I'm sure he has all these ideas going on, and, you know, you just latch onto, oh, look at these two characters. They're pretty good. Let me go off in this direction with these characters. Yeah, I mean, we can't speculate on what he was thinking, but knowing where Gaiman's writing goes after this, I mean, into the novels he wrote, especially American Gods, because a lot of these themes that he explores in the Death stories, he expands on immensely in American Gods.
Yeah.
So knowing where he goes from here, you can see that, you know, there's obviously ideas and themes that he's very, very interested in, and he expands on those going forward. As you do when you write. Let's talk about some of the art in this too.
There was one other thematic thing, but let's talk about that.
Well, do the theme.
All right.
Do theme, then art.
So I'm curious about your opinion on Dee Dee.
The girl Dee Dee?
The girl, yeah. So I think what he did there is very fascinating, because the question is, did Dee Dee... So Dee Dee has a past story where the people around her know her, and of course have known her for all these 15 years. They know her family, you know, they know her parents, they know how she grew up. Mrs. Robbins, the lady who runs the fruit stand in front of her building, all of these things. Now, we're told semi-conflicting things at various points, I believe very much on purpose. So I'm saying they're conflicting on purpose, not that it's a mistake on Gaiman's part.
It's not a plot hole.
It's not a plot hole. It's very intentional. So we are alternately, I believe, expected to believe that she was a real person that Death has inhabited, or conversely, She has never existed before, but the universe has created her and her backstory to accommodate for Death being this human character. So we're also given her backstory that the people who think they have known her all their life know that she had this heart problem. So when she dies at the end of, so Dee Dee dies,
yeah.
Giving that away, kids. So when Dee Dee dies at the end, oh, it's because she's had this heart problem throughout her life. Mrs. Robbins is like, oh, she was always close to death anyway.
Close to death.
Yeah. And of course, her name is Dee Dee, D-I-D-I, you know, that's a little obvious, but still kind of fun. So what do you think, Paul?
It was, you know, originally...
Or does it matter which the real truth is?
Either way works, and it's fine. That gets back to that ambiguity thing. But when I first read these stories, I always assumed that Dee Dee was a real person who died.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, naturally, because of her heart problem and so forth. That was my assumption, is that she was a real person who died, and then Death said, hey, I need this 24 hours.
Right. And Death would know that she was going to die in 24 hours.
Yes. Well, Death is there for all of us. So she's there, and then, gives her an extra day so that they both can have the day together. That was my understanding. But the other one works well, too. If you want to just say it was a cosmic invention and, you know, the universe placed this backstory in everyone's head, that works just as well.
The universe made her always exist.
Exactly. And either way works. Either way, it doesn't matter, because that's not the point of the story.
Exactly. But I think that it is a very interesting, this is the strength of Gaiman, is it's a very interesting tweak and idea that is relatively, now I haven't read every piece of literature written in the Eastern and Western world since the beginning of time.
What?
I know, right? But to me, it's like, especially when I first read it, and so going back and reading this, I remember being confused by this, and I remember at various points being given to believe different things within the narrative, and rereading it, it does. It definitely presents an opening for you to interpret how you want.
Exactly, and that is a very typical plot device in traditional fairy tales and mythology,
right?
Where, you know, this is what the gods do, and it's okay. You know, if you don't understand it, it's okay. If it's not explained to you, that's okay, because this is just the jumping off point to get us to the story, to get us to the you know, how we're supposed to feel. I honestly think, and now we can, you know, this could start a whole new tangent. But we don't need to know the backstory of every single character. We don't need to have everything explained to us.
It's kind of why with certain characters in this, I didn't want to talk about their appearance in the other Gaiman series, because it's not overly important. And what we need to know about their appearance elsewhere, I'm talking particularly of Foxglove and Hazel.
Right. Knowing that, that's great. You know, that's a little Easter egg for you to know about, but it's not important to the story.
Right. And they give us enough reference to the fact that something very bad happened that you don't need. All you need to know is that, a bad thing happened.
Yeah. I mean, to use a different different story as an analogy, are we better off to know that midichlorians help the Force? Do we need to know that? Does that make the story better?
Oh, good Lord, no.
No, exactly. All you got to do is know, I mean, I'm just using Star Wars as an example.
I think we're better off having never known that.
Yeah, the Force is surrounds us, binds us, it holds the universe, or it holds the galaxy together. That's all you got to know. It's space magic. That's all you got to know. How did Dee Dee come into existence? Was she real? Was she just an embodiment of a human personification of Death? Doesn't matter. That's not what the story is.
But it does lead to the very lovely moment at the very end when she then dies and returns and meets Death and returns to the aspect of Death, which is, it's a very well done, and maybe that leads us into the art that you wanted to talk to, because it's a very well rendered and quite lovely scene.
Yeah. Well, the art throughout is really good. Really good. Yeah, way to go, Paul. Great way to describe that. Art, good.
Art is good. Man, I do that all the time. It's when I can't think of anything better to say, good. Yeah. It was good.
But there's so many things, the way the panels are laid out. Like there's one issue, I think it's issue two, where Hetty is dancing while making or trying to make tea.
Oh, yeah.
She just kind of breaks the plane and goes from panel to panel in mm-hmm. this little dance. And it's so nice. And it really enhances who this character is. Because up until then, she's just this crazy, you know, bag lady.
Right.
He likes to hold bottles to people's necks. And now we get this wonderful kind of giddy exuberance from her. And
well, if I had lost my heart, I would do the, you know.
Well, yeah, absolutely. My point is that the art enhances the characterization.
Oh yeah, there's this one panel. It's a tiny little panel at the bottom. It's when Sexton is first taken in by Dee Dee Death, and she fixes his pants and whatever, and he loses his temper with her because he thinks she's crazy, and he like storms out the door. And there's this one really tall panel or really small panel at the bottom after he walks out. That's just a picture of Death. Like she's just shrugging and putting her hands up, and she's like mugging literally for the reader. And it's like Jim from The Office almost. Pre-Office. But if that gives people a sense of like what that panel is, she's just kind of, and she kind of has her head cocked to one side and smiles, and she's like, "Who, me?"
Yeah. Yeah, and exactly. She's like, go figure. Great.
And it's Chris Boccolo. And I'm never sure. Is it Boccolo, Boccolo?
Let's go with Boccolo. Boccolo sounds like something you need to have some penicillin.
And I'm sure he's listening to this, so he can write to us and let us know exactly. But he's been one of my favorite artists for a long time, from his work on Shade the Changing Man up until most recently his work on Doctor Strange with Jason Aaron. Mm-hmm. I just love...
Oh, that's right.
I love his representations. I mean, he does creepy monsters and creepy scenes really well. They're cartoony, but also horrifying at the same time. Like, they're almost funny, scary.
Yeah, it's great. And like I said, it enhances... He has a way of making the casual moments where they're just sitting by a fountain talking. He makes that visually interesting and imbues it with this just a nice, heartwarming feeling. But then when you get into the darker aspects of things, it's scary.
He can turn on a dime.
Yeah, he adds a level of horror to these stories, which, whew, goodness gracious.
and I also have to, the big props to Mark Buckingham's ink work, too.
Okay, I will admit, I find it harder to... I mean, unless someone has like a real heavy inking style or scratchy, I have a hard time seeing the styles of different inkers. When something's done well, I can see that it's done well. But
I think you can tell from if you follow like an artist from inker to inker. Now, some artists, of course, do their own inking, and some like use the same inker on almost all of their stuff. I think that's way more common nowadays because it's easier for artists, artistic teams to stick together from project to project, not necessarily with the big two, but of course, certainly going to Marvel or certainly going to Image or what have you, or some of the other smaller, quote unquote, smaller publishing houses. Yeah. But
I mean, I know back in the 70s, they would just kind of pass things around of who was available at the time. But
right.
That was a completely different time.
But Death will always, other artists have done Death, and the collection I have, I don't know if your collection was the same as mine that had all these other short stories or whatnot, but there's a great gallery in the back of all kinds of like named,
yes,
you know, massively important artists like doing, you know, pinups and sketches of Death. They all have their unique take on it. They all follow the same model, but they have their unique take on it. But I think even more than Dringenberg, who helped create her, it's Boccolo's representation of her that I always think of first and foremost when I sit at night contemplating Death.
Yeah, I agree. When I think of this character, that's what comes to mind immediately.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's very specifically his line work and just the way that it just really is so strong. And even when he presents her in the first series as younger and in the next series, which we'll probably get to in a minute or so, as older, Like, you know, we go from like 16 to probably late 20s, early 30s as the representation that is closest to how Gaiman used her in the other unnamed series.
Yeah. So, you know, and again, to get back, you know, how Gaiman works with his artists, there's a really great trust there for,
right.
I've mentioned this multiple times on the show. When an artist and a writer are really connecting with one another, boy, comic books are can be great.
Yes.
You know, it's really a joy to see. And this is one of those pairings that is just brilliant.
And it continues on to the next series.
Let's have the time of our life, Brian.
Let's have the time of our life.
Now, you said at the top that you weren't as enamored of this one.
In reading it again, coming back after some time and reading it again, I thought the story was a little thin. Not much happens, and I'm not opposed to stories where not much happens when thematically they're interesting in terms of what is not happening is as interesting as what is happening. I felt like a lot of time was spent with some origins that weren't particularly necessary. I thought there were characters that were introduced that didn't need to be introduced, that didn't seem to have any point.
You're not going to say that about Boris, are you?
Not Boris.
Okay.
Yeah, no, Boris is a great character, but like Vito, I have no idea why Vito existed in this story. He doesn't even work as someone to really play off of. And then at the end, when he has an opportunity to do something interesting, he's just sort of like, oh, no, I'm not interested in doing anything interesting.
And again, I think that was just, he was a representation of superficiality. So,
right.
You know, so she's almost, Foxglove, that is walking around with the human embodiment of a blank slate, which is what she's becoming. She is becoming that superficiality. She is becoming that nothingness.
Right, but then she represents that. Why do you need Vito to represent that as well? It doesn't work as a foil.
Well, it's just sort of she's walking around between two people. You have Boris, who's the protector and the one who's sort of the conscience and doing the right thing, and then you have this celebrity nothingness, and she's walking between the two the entire time. So I think it's more of a symbol of it. I mean, I get what you're saying. That he really is kind of nothing, but that's sort of what he's supposed to be.
Right.
So I can understand not liking it, but you can't criticize it for being what it's supposed to be. But no, I get what you're saying. Because
I'm curious if that was the intent, but if that's the intent.
That's what I took from it. Yeah.
Sure, that works. And then
he's also supposed to be, you know, our guy in the same way Sexton worked as, you know, he's the one who gets to ask the questions of what's this and why is this happening? Because everybody seems to know what's going on.
But Sexton is a way more interesting character.
I agree. That's fine.
And then the yard worker at Hazel and Foxglove's estate, he didn't even play off Hazel all that well in it. It was just sort of like, I guess he's used to ask a couple questions that avoids us having to do thought balloons, maybe.
Yeah.
But it seemed like he was inserted to mean something and the only thing I could think of is, were we supposed to think he's the one that killed Alvy? But that's me really trying to stretch this out to give him a reason for existing.
I honestly think he's just there to, it's a way to have conversational exposition rather than just here's a whole bunch of panels just, you know, trying to describe what's going on. And instead Gaiman chose to do that through conversation. So there's nothing more significant to it than that, I think.
No, his character has no significance.
No, he's not supposed to. He's there to,
he's there
to get us up to speed on what's going on.
He just seemed really extraneous. And, you know, it's when you could have gone with economy, it seemed like it wasn't an economical choice in terms of storytelling.
It was a stylistic choice. And it didn't bother me. Apparently it bothered you. But, you know, you're saying that nothing happens. I mean, a baby dies in the very beginning.
Yes. That's... a baby dies, a manager dies, and then ultimately a shepherd dies. Because, of course, we find out that Boris's name is really Endymion.
Yes.
And you're the mythology guy, so I had to look it up. Well, I was like, his name's Endymion. That's important. It means something. I have a basic knowledge of archetypes and mythological characters and whatnot, but I had to look it up. And of course, Endymion is, as you already know, but is often represented in mythology as a shepherd.
Yes. He's a shepherd and a hunter, and a protector, someone who.
And a protector, yeah. So
almost used as a kind of guardian angel. Commonly represented as a guardian angel. But this also is a typical trope of Gaiman, having a character with some crazy mythological name, like Sexton.
Like Sexton.
Yeah, because that's a common name in New York in the 1990s. But, you know, I kind of enjoy that, too, that you have these very plain characters, but they always have these grand mythological names.
Just to lay out a little bit more, and then, of course, you can respond, because I think you felt it. It's a good story. I just don't think it's as strong. But I feel like a lot of the story, this story is sort of emo exposition. It's a lot of people feeling bad about things. And, you know, and everybody's kind of terrible. It makes... So Foxglove and Hazel at this point are a full-on couple. Foxglove is a musician of quite some note. Hazel is the stay-at-home mom. And, of course, so Foxglove, in a shocking turn of events for a musician touring the world, has had numerous affairs, and Hazel doesn't know about these, but probably suspects. So Foxglove is having all this sort of existential angst. She loses her manager, Larry, who was a great character. I was really upset when Larry dies because he's like that funny New York guy that, not initially from New York, what have you. But
I love the fact that he's always going, "Hey, Bubba, you're not Jewish."
Right.
See, I love that.
Look, I think it's something like it's New York or it's the business that I'm supposed to say this.
Yeah. But I love those little character, just little things that they throw in there and you get who that person is.
And of course, his death early on works as a catalyst in some ways. So yes, you need a catalyst.
Yeah. He becomes the herald to draw the wayward character.
And he appears to Foxglove and he tells Foxglove to listen to whatever Hazel says. And of course, Foxglove, in another shocking plot twist, doesn't listen to the advice she's given. Some things happen in between all the emotional soul-searching that everybody is doing.
There's some lovely moments, though. I mean, when Hazel tells Death the story of how they met and that one magical night that they had together, you know, it's really a lovely story. And then the twist on that is she asks Foxglove if she remembers that night. She has no clue.
Right, and Hazel is set up as the story keeper.
So there's all these mythological archetypes that are going on in here. It's really quite nice. I do want to point out one thing, that in the very beginning when Foxglove goes to the movies, did you see what movie she's seeing? Batman Again.
Oh, Batman Again, yes.
Which is just funny. All right. Sorry, that just popped
in. No. Yeah, that was a good,
Batman Again?
In a comic book being made by DC Comics.
So what we're, you know, what we're kind of getting here in this story is Orpheus and Eurydice. So you have to go into death and then and coming out.
So to clarify,
going into the underworld and coming back.
Right. So to clarify, Hazel or Alvy, which is the child of Hazel and Foxglove, dies, and Hazel makes a deal with death to have some more time.
Of natural causes, we should say.
Right, it dies of natural.
There wasn't any murder.
It's not the suspicious gardener.
Yes, it was just it was crib death. So
so she makes a deal, and death actually is so Hazel's like is like you're the one from the club. So this is part of the carryover from the previous mini, where Hazel remembers Death from the club and even confesses to having a crush on her. And Death admits, and Hazel's like, you know, is pleading for more time with Alvy. And, you know, so Death makes a deal with him that she gets a little bit more time. But at the end of that time, at the end of the time of your life, someone has to stay behind in Death's realm. And, you know, so Hazel, of course, asks, she's like, you know, this isn't something you normally do. And Death is like, well, no, I have a, Death admits to having a stronger pull towards, or admits to having a little bit more care and concern for this particular group of characters, particularly Hazel and Foxglove, going back to her 24 hours of being human. So it does reference it back. And that is a neat idea and a neat scene where even one of the Endless can retain some of what... So she retained that aspect of her 24 hours as a human. She retained some emotional or, I guess, just emotional attachment to...
And that's kind of the point of her doing that every 100 years is to understand the humanity.
And to remind her of what it's, you know, of what it means when she does her day job.
I'm sorry. I cut you off.
So the whole point of this is to go back to what you had said before is, so yes, it's the journey into Hades to bring back, but someone stays behind or don't look back. So there's a determination made at the end of it. Things lead to its natural conclusion. Everybody ends up in Death's realm, and Death says, someone's got to stay here. And so then there's, you know, more kind of exposition and whatnot. And then somebody finally breaks down and says, I'll stay behind so Foxglove and Hazel can have Alvy the kid back.
And they get to, and Foxglove gives up her celebrity lifestyle.
Gives up her career.
And they go and just be normal people. Just a normal couple raising the kid.
They go to the 7-Eleven and Hazel learns to drive.
Yeah.
And then Foxglove says she doesn't love Hazel anymore. And Hazel laughs and says, of course you do. And then everything is resolved. And Foxglove is like, oh yeah, you're right, I do. And so then they're back in love again. Because Hazel said, but you do love me.
And, but...
but it's literally that.
I know, but what does it end with? But what does it end with? She says, and then eventually I go back to sleep. It's, you know, yes, everything's great, but it might not be great. You know, things are going to get rough again because they're just...
Well, they're regular, they're human beings.
They're regular human beings, exactly.
They're human beings who are a couple, and of course, as you know, all couples have their moments where I don't always love you, but I always like you.
Yeah. exactly. So, I mean, but overall, I mean, this is all very Greek mythology in a modern setting, which is something Gaiman does a lot because he loves the myth.
But I guess I wonder the necessity of this second mini. Many people will tell, you know, many people will disagree with me. I mean, for some people, this is their favorite of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're...
There's some very moving moments in this to me. I mean, like I said, that story that Hazel tells and then the turnaround that... The idea that the things that we hold dear, the memories that we think are sacred, someone else doesn't even enter into their consciousness. And it's how we perceive each other and how we perceive our own lives is quite different than what, you know, we're always the hero of our own story, but
right.
But we're not the hero in someone else's. And that's, you know, that can be tough to actually come to that understanding. That's what makes Foxglove's life so miserable. She's trying to be this superstar. She's trying to live the life of the rock star, but that's not the life she wants. So she's actually destroying herself because she just wants to, she wants to be the hero of someone else's story.
Right.
And that's never going to happen. Anyway, there are lovely little moments like that throughout this.
I don't want to completely negate because I do agree with you that there are very nice moments and the art as ever is great. And there are some thematic things that are touched on that I think work really well. But for the most part, I felt like this could have been a 48 page one-off. There's too many notes.
It's being one who really likes lots of notes. I think they're like little, great little touches, especially in the artwork, like when they're reading the National Enquirer or the Weekly World News.
I think. Oh, the Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly and Foxglove have been seen together. That's brilliant.
In the desert.
Yes. Yes. There's just so many little touches. Like Boris used to be a roadie for The Who. That's why he's Boris the Spider.
Right.
And if you don't know that, it doesn't matter, I guess. But it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's lovely. And then the art style in this, again, you mentioned that, but when they're crossing basically the River Styx.
Right. And the umbrella.
And an umbrella next to a giant foxglove flower with a fox sitting on it. It's really compelling to me.
Yeah.
And I love the aspect that it's just a myth. It's just a retelling of an old mythological story with updates and
right.
little twists on it.
And bad lyrics.
Again, I think that's intentional. I mean, her album is called Slits of Love.
some of that is very much of the time too.
Yes. The CD itself, did you see? They have the actual CD with a slit down the middle.
Yes. What's a CD?
Well, you see, in the old days, you used to have to get music.
I found one. I couldn't find any buttons on it. I held it up to my ear and I couldn't listen to it.
And in the really old days, there used to be these, well, no, hipsters know what vinyl is. You know what? I get it's not as overly symbolic as the first one.
Well, and I think
that's not the right word.
I felt like there wasn't as much, as much wonder or joy attached to it. And
yeah.
That's okay. But to me, it's like I found the first series to have more of that. And I think that appealed to me more strongly than sort of the very, it's a very, the second one is very dour.
Yes. Well, it is very,
which is fine.
It's centered around a dead baby. So yes.
How much joy can you take from dead baby?
Nature, yeah. By its very nature, it's going to be dour.
Dead babies
are on the maudlin side, but I do like, cause you know, it's the way he tells the story, the way Gaiman tells the story is that you think it's going to be Foxglove. She's been having these basically death dreams throughout the entire story. But then Endymion, the shepherd, steps in at the last moment.
I thought, because it had been so long since I read it, my memory was a little sketchy. I knew the basic beats. When I was reading it, I remembered the basic beats of each story. But for some reason, as I was reading it, I was like, it's going to be Vito. Partly because I wanted him to have a purpose to existing in this comic. So I actually thought it was going to be Vito more than Foxglove or Boris or Hazel or Larry. Oh,
yeah. See, Vito and Boris, I just see as, you know, the angel and devil on your shoulder is how I see them in this, their roles in the story. And then of course, Boris steps up and becomes more than that in the end. Whereas Vito is given the opportunity and he says, nah, I'm not, I'd rather just live. Because
right.
He's so superficial that all he cares about is himself,
and eventually just gets busted having orgies or what have you. That's the other great part about reading the paper, and it's like, you know, Vito or whatever the supermodel suspected of having wild orgies, and I forget the headline, but
exactly, yeah. So asexual deviant in the end. I just like it. The relationship between Foxglove and Hazel is very tender and very real.
Mm-hmm.
They care about their kid. And the ultimate goal here is that one of them is going to sacrifice himself so that the child can live. It's a good story.
it's a good story.
Yeah, you are correct, though, that death does not have her effervescence. You know, she's not as bubbly as we see her in other stories.
And, you know, I certainly don't want to, you know, say like a female personification of anything is supposed to be bubbly and happy. That's not what.
No. But that's her character.
But that is her character.
That is supposed to be death instead of being this horrible, terrible sadness. Is actually
maybe happy. Ultimately the story is maybe the all ultimately the story is bittersweet.
Yes, I agree with that. Okay.
I don't know. Do you have anything else to?
No, I just in the end, like I said in the beginning, huge fan of Neil Gaiman. Basically can do no wrong. Even the stuff I don't like of Neil Gaiman, I really kind of like it, actually. Still kind of like it. So, I haven't read these stories in quite a while. It's really great to go back to them and just remember how good they are.
Yeah.
You know, this, aside from the fact that they're just very good stories with beautiful artwork, they have influenced so many people to the way, I mean, think about the way anything from Image is being told. And that goes back to this period. This is when really the way comics told stories changed, and gaming was a big part of that.
And I think Duff, if it wasn't the very first comic to have the Vertigo tag on it, it was one of the very first. I'd have to research it, but part of me seems to remember that Vertigo might have, of course, Vertigo came about because of Sandman and Animal Man and all of the various
Swamp Thing and so forth.
Swamp Thing, Hellblazer, that were going on at the time. But I have a vague memory of, and maybe we should have fact checked this before we started, but I do have a vague memory.
Let's just wildly speculate and throw out things we don't
understand. Sure, it's the internet. If it was not the first Vertigo tagged comic, it was certainly one of the first.
Oh, and before we go, we really should mention Dave McKean's covers.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, he is, you know, the you cannot look at one of his covers and not think, that's Vertigo.
He's the master, and all of his covers, and his interior art, which he, you know, did obviously more of back in the day, of Cages is quite a fantastic piece of work as well. But his covers, yeah, you can't separate the Endless Universe or without, you can't separate McKeon from the Endless Universe. I mean, any visual idea we have of that world is certainly strongly represented by McKeon's cover art. Always. And but to the point where, like, with the new Sandman comics coming out, or the Sandman Universe comics coming out, I was doing my orders for those, and I made sure I selected the one, the variants or what have you, with the McKeon covers. Some of the other covers are very pretty and very nice, and there's some great artists doing it, but I was like, I want to keep it all together. I want my Dave McKeon covers.
Yes, absolutely. They're so cool. That's what you had to say. They're just cool.
Yeah.
So I guess that's it.
I think that's it. So we both give a thumbs up
to death. We're both fans of death.
Yeah. So a thumbs up for The Time of Your Life, two thumbs up, and we get a one thumb up for The High Cost of Living, and a thumb
sideways.
So yes. Two thumbs up and one and a half thumbs up.
One and a half thumbs up. That's okay.
After that scintillating conversation,
yes,
Paul, I believe it is your turn next to recommend something for us to read.
Indeed.
What pray tell do you have for us for our next session?
So next time on the program, we'll be taking a journey back to the 1970s.
Woo!
Woo-hoo! For Luke Cage, Power Man.
All right.
Specifically, we'll be talking about the Marvel Masterworks Edition, Volume 2. This collects Power Man issues number 17 to 31, and it features the talents of Tony Isabella, Len Wein, Don McGregor, and others. And it introduces such classic villains as Cottonmouth, Piranha Jones, and the truly unbelievable Mr. Fish.
Sweet Christmas, that sounds like fun.
Indeed. It's 70 street-level gloriosity. So that's Power Man, Marvel Masterworks, Volume 2.
Oh, that's going to be a fun one.
Yes. Yeah, I'm a big fan of 70s comics, so this should be fun.
Excellent.
Okay, so anyone, please leave us your feedback. Send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. Comments on individual episodes at collectededitionpodcast.com. Follow us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And if you could leave us, and let's say that again, leave us a review on iTunes. That helps us get found. So appreciate it if you did that. Preferably a good one. That would be nice. Anything else, Brian?
I've got nothing else.
All right. So till next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
there's so much out there that tickles my fancy. Yeah. And that did not.
Which is, so, you know, like, why is Tom King doing such a great job on Mr. Miracle and has completely destroyed the Batman franchise in one single issue?
Wow. That, see, okay, let's talk about that, because I don't agree with that at all.
okay. Now, let's leave it and let it stew for a little bit.
Okay. So we don't want to talk about 50.
Yeah, let's leave it alone at this moment.
Okay. Maybe I'll tease it. Hey, tease it. We're going to talk about 50. Not this time, because there might be pain.